WilderUtopia.com celebrates world culture and literary expression and our inspiration sources from folklore, myth, and storytelling, as well as the rituals and traditions of the many peoples of the planet. My name is Jack Eyde, and let's go on a wild ride into the wilderness of literary imagination. It's a venerable carnival of the animals out there. If you put your ear to the ground, you can hear them coming.
They came to me with a labyrinth idea, and I have, since I was 18 years old, had various ideas for labyrinth-type stories, which for me is metaphor for the unconscious and for the collective unconscious. I'm a bit Jungian in my orientation, so I think there is validity in the concept of the collective unconscious.
Stephen T. Vessels, an accomplished literary writer, poet, visual artist, and classical musicologist of sorts, passed away after a brief illness in August 2021. His enigmatic oeuvre, however, will continue to resound as some of his more serious works find their way into the public realm. He has published a short story collection, two novels, and has appeared in a multitude of journals and anthologies. In 2021, he published the short story, The Artist and the Octopus, appearing in the Santa Barbara Literary Journal, alongside one of my stories called The Fortunate One. And in 2022, an anthology dedicated to Stephen, The Fifth Fedora, Weird Noir and Stranger Tales, has been published by Borda Books and Wilder Utopia Books. It includes his transformative literary science fiction story, The Key Trees. To be sure, his work operates on the razor's edge of surreality, with a sneaking dark side that you might understand better if you imagine yourself, upon opening his books, pushing through a curtain and appearing in a landscape unrecognizable, fantastic maybe, populated by people who may appear as monstrous, entities who, innocent enough, but what lurks on the other side is something one would have to keep reading to find out. I've been considering the term he used himself, a literary mystic. Try and explain what that means, I dare you. Here is an excerpt from The Artist and the Octopus, read by Jessica Aldridge.
From the Santa Barbara Literary Journal, Volume 7, O Fortuna, an excerpt from The Artist and the Octopus by Stephen T. Vessels. The bartender cut him off, herded him outside. There were few cars on the street and no pedestrians, and then remembered a dumpster behind a restaurant a few blocks away. Trying somewhat pointlessly not to weave on the sidewalk, he carried the box there. The dumpster was full, mounded with garbage propping up the lid. He didn't want to leave his art on top of that either. He set the cube down, lit a cigarette, and drifted off a few yards, thinking. A transient odor of sewage stung his nostrils. It came to him what to do. He would take his art to the waterfront and chuck it in the river. Quick footsteps sounded behind him. Emin looked back to see a hooded figure make off with the box. Hey! Emin ran after him. The thief was young and fast, and Emin was drunk, but he was angry. He wasn't going to let some punk determine the fate of his work. Nevertheless, he tried, and the distance between them grew. Just when Emin thought he'd lost the chase, the thief looked back, shouted some taunt, and tripped on the curbstone. The box flew from his grasp as he fell. Edmund pushed himself and closed the distance before the thief could recover. The box had landed on the steps of an upscale apartment building. The thief got back up, looked at the box and Edmund. For an instant, their eyes locked. He was just a kid, maybe 14 years old. Edmund hurled a savage cry and the boy bolted to the end of the block and around the corner. Edmund leaned on the railing by the steps, catching his breath. His heart pounding triple time, it felt like his chest would explode. He steadied his breathing, shook his head at the absurdity of what he had just done, and lit another cigarette. The kid reemerged from around the corner, accompanied by two older but much bigger youths. Edmund stared at them a beat, flicked the cigarette away, and snatched up the box, preparing to run. He didn't expect to get far. The doorman opened the door of the apartment building and leaned out. "That's the thing?" he asked. and then blinked at him. Any port in the storm? Yeah, it's the thing. He leapt up the stairs and ducked inside. They said you'd be coming. The doorman secured the door and pointed across a wood-paneled lobby. Elevator on the left. Edmund let the doorman take the lead and glanced back. The three hoodlums reached the entrance and glared at him through the glass door. He followed the doorman past the reception desk to the elevator bay, along the way catching a glimpse of himself in a gold-framed mirror. He'd never seen himself look so wretched. The doorman pushed the button for the elevator. I have to key you in. Edmund couldn't think how to explain himself. You want me to deliver it? He asked inanely. I'm not going up there, the doorman said. He already lied. If he came clean, the doorman might kick him back outside. His three pursuers still watched from the street. The door opened, and he boarded the elevator. The doorman leaned in, turned a cylindrical key in a slot, punched the button of the penthouse, and left Edmund to his fate. The doors closed and the elevator rose. Edmund sometimes yielded to random impulses intentionally on the premise that an artist had to, now and then, invite new ideas. He wasn't an artist anymore. The elevator opened into a small vestibule with olive-green walls. Facing tall double doors of dark wood, Edmund stepped off and the elevator closed behind him. Gilded foliar sconces with flame-shaped light bulbs flanked the doors. Mounted above a peephole in the left door was a small brass medallion bearing a hexagram. Edmund decided to wait there a while. Let the young thief and his cohorts tire and seek other mischief. The door opened, and a huge bald-headed man well over 6 feet tall stared down at him. Muscles bulged in the man's blazer. The room behind him was dark. Did he bring it? Called a voice from inside. The giant frowned at Edmund's white cube. Before Edmund could react, he took it from him, pried at the edges. He brought the box, he answered in an East European accent. What? A box. How does this open? He asked Edmund. It doesn't. Bring it here, said the voice. The giant withdrew, and Edmund haltingly pursued him to a vast, darkly shadowed room with big sofas and armchairs, low tables and large paintings on the walls. One might have been a Boccioni, an abstraction of a gyrating figure. To the left, through a broad entry, a standing lamp dimly illuminated a strange tableau in an adjoining room. Two silhouetted figures stood by a wheeled hospital bed blocking Edmund's view of the person lying in it. Show it to me, said the person on the bed. Open it. The giant held the box up for the person to see. He says you can't open it. Bring him here. The giant stomped back, seized Edmund by the arm, and propelled him forward. Edmund stared about in an inebriate daze. As he crossed the threshold into the far room, his attention lulled, left to shock him with the spectacle of a stone Buddha 15 feet tall. Hello there, called the voice from the bed. Edmund couldn't imagine how they'd gotten the statue up here. It had to weigh tons. What's this box, some riddle? Where's the Neurogalactic Cross? The Buddha had been shocking, but the man on the bed was a phenomenon of another order. His face was streaked with blood, and he had an octopus on his head. Edmund was bereft for words. Speak up. What is in the box? The man had an upper British accent. My creativity, Edmund answered without thinking.
On a personal level, Stephen Vessels has been a fixture at the Santa Barbara Writers Conference since about 2007 and has become a beloved figure to a cadre of accomplished and aspiring writers. He has furthermore expanded his reach into literary circles in the thriller, science fiction, and fantasy worlds. When Stephen was at his literary best, he transcended all genres. That, of course, is a liability in the publishing industry, as the challenging nature of his works kept him from properly making a living at his craft. But that did not stop him in the slightest. He has stated his literary inspirations are stories by Edgar Allan Poe, Ambrose Bierce, Thomas Hardy, H.G. Wells, William Faulkner, Ernest Hemingway, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Henry James, Guy de Maupassant, Edith Wharton, Rudyard Kipling, Isaac Dinesen, and H.P. Lovecraft. Following is a two-part conversation I had with Stephen at the 2019 Santa Barbara Writers Conference. As he is now gone, this will have to do for those who never met this amazing human. Here is my discussion with Stephen T. Vessels. Hey, this is Jack Eid. I'm speaking with Stephen Vessels outside of the Santa Barbara Writers Conference. So, Stephen, why don't you let us know what you've been writing on, working on, publishing? Just tell us what you're up to.
Well, thank you, Jack. Nice to be here. Got a nice surround, pleasant surround, beautiful ocean, nice cloudy day, good writer's weather. The thing that I have upcoming is I have a second novel in the Labyrinth of Souls series from Shadow Spinners Press. It's an unusual series of books. I guess I can go into that a little bit. The way that the series, it's called the Labyrinth of Souls series, the way it came into being was, I know a circle of writers in Eugene, Oregon that I met through John Reed, and one of them is a game designer, and he created a card game, role-playing game. And working with a artist in Germany, they created a tarot deck specifically for the game, which I will never learn how to play. About 250-page rule book that is...
How does tarot find its way into literature?
It wasn't really. What happened was that, I mean, it is for me, but the other writers in the series, it varies how much they invest themselves in that particular occult discipline. Elizabeth Engstrom, who's a fairly well-known author, is a sort of our den mother, a literary den mother up there, and she came up with the idea because the artwork on the cards is very beautiful. It's very dark, but it's very, very beautifully done, and she thought that each of us might write a novel with the shared theme of Labyrinth of Souls. These were all standalone novels. They're not interdependent upon each other. And then pick a card from the deck that seemed to express or echo what our book was about, the theme of the book, however people wanted to approach that. And then that would be used as the cover for the book. So it sort of has this signature to the series that they all have this specific artwork on the covers.
What's your angle? I mean, like what?
Well, for me, it was kind of like duck to water because they came to me with a labyrinth idea, and I have, since I was 18 years old, had various ideas for labyrinth-type stories, which for me is metaphor for the unconscious and for the collective unconscious. I'm a bit Jungian in my orientation, so I think there is validity in the concept of the collective unconscious, and it provides a wonderful playground for the imagination. And to me, the imagination is the most powerful asset that we have. And the idea of imaginative literature, to me, is to spark the imagination of the reader and enliven the scope of the experience of living, giving you different ways to look at things. And so this was, you want me to write a novel in this series? Well, what a novel idea. I've never thought of doing anything like that. Let me think about it. Sure. I'd be happy to. And so I did incorporate somewhat invisibly the notion of the tarot, because I have sort of played around with the tarot for many years. I regarded as a way of predicting the present. And I don't look at it in the divinatory way that some people do. I don't put that down.
Predicting as a divinatory.
Yes, but predicting the present. Not, you know.
Every day is different.
Every day. No, you don't. You don't know what's going to happen. And so I let my imagination run free, and I wanted to write the first novel that I wrote for the series was The Door of Tireless Pursuit, which I wanted to write a romantic adventure. And so I created this fantastic realm, and this fellow inadvertently falls in love with this woman who has special powers and gets transported into this underground realm trying to rescue her, and he goes on a wild ride. And it gave me the opportunity to examine consciousness in different ways. Take a different element to the writing of the story than might commonly be brought to a lot of fantasy. I don't like to single myself out as an innovator or anything like that, but I do have, I'm quite broadly read, and I like many different kinds of literature, not just fantasy and science fiction. I like everything from Proust to Beckett to James Lee Burke and Agatha Christie. And I threw a tarot before I wrote the book, and I made a lot of notes on that, and I forgot about it. And then when I read the book after I'd written it, I realized that it really did echo the tarot throw. That was an interesting thing.
What's your name? He blinked at her. Sandy. Alexander. My friends call me Sandy. Sandy, I'm Quince, and my friends call me Lark. She held his face in her hands. I didn't pick you, and you didn't pick me. We found each other. Understand? He shook his head. She placed her hand on his heart. Stop thinking. Just feel. You said you love me. Did you mean it? He swallowed. Yes. Looking in her eyes, it still felt true. Spontaneous emotion had become balled up in confusion. Again, though, it was the only answer his mind made room for. Again with that smile. Good. I know it seems impossible, but I love you too. And right now I want you to trust me. Can you do that? Changes took place in his body, mind, and being he could never have named. All he had to say was yes, and so he squared up and said it like a prayer. Wow, she said, this time out loud. He wanted to make her laugh again, so he made a face, and she did, and he stopped caring where he was or what made sense or how the world was meant to be. She led him down to a subway station, and they boarded a train. They sat down, and she snuggled against him, and he felt suffused by holy grace, and all uncertainty about the immediate course of his life was vanquished. He nevertheless stared about in continued bewilderment. This is New York, isn't it? He felt her head nod against his chest. He'd told her he would trust her, so he did, and set aside needing to understand, yielding to the ameliorating confirmation of a childhood belief, never fully relinquished, that magic existed, and the world was more than it seemed. They reached a stop, and he followed her back up to the street. They seemed to be somewhere in Chinatown. Past another series of turns, through streets redolent of fish, herbs, and refuse, she led him down a narrow flight of stairs to a red door. Let me do the talking, she said. From The Door of Tireless Pursuit, a Labyrinth of Souls novel. And I'm Christine Casey Logsdon. Thank you for letting me read.
The second book, the book that is going to be published this year, which is The Ruptured Firmament, is actually, I want it to be read as a sequel. It's actually a prequel, but I'm asking for it to be called a sequel because I want it to be read in that order, going back in time.
A prequel to The Door of
Tireless Pursuit. To The Door of Tireless Pursuit, right, yeah. And this one starts off as a murder mystery and involves a detective finds is assigned a grisly murder case, and in the course of investigating it, gets drawn down into the Labyrinth of Souls and hooks up with a Carmelite nun who has also inadvertently gotten dragged down there, and they both have a lot of revelatory experiences along the way, and then have a battle with a really, really evil, evil, evil villain.
I feel that myth and folklore are part of this process? Is that
Yeah, it is.
The concept of labyrinth. So you started off saying I'm inspired by Labyrinth. What does that mean? What is Labyrinth?
Well, I think the labyrinth, the concept of a labyrinth, is a very powerful metaphor for the unconscious. And when I'm dealing in symbols and semiotics and study of signs and what's sort of cosmological theorizing, I don't really concern myself with whether I'm being true to the historical. I don't align myself with any historical
existing myths that are up.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be true to. Yeah. I'm not
well,
trying to be.
You're creating. I mean, there's a certain amount of retelling, I think, that happens because we're all a product, as you said. You're well read and you're influenced by all these things, but how you distill them is really where the magic comes.
Yeah, there was the book that Guy Davenport wrote. What was it called? It was about how an image can be re-seen and reinterpreted over time accidentally until it loses its original meaning. And I'm not trying to do that. I just like to let the myths and the symbols and the cosmologies, I'm just trying to get them to dance together and give the authority of interpretation to a large extent to the reader, and just trying to create a rich environment for their mind to play in. And I have my own perceptions and my own ideas that get inserted. I don't really worry about that in the storytelling process. I figure whatever I have to say is going to go in there. I can't stop it. So I try and be true to the story that comes to me and render that with as much clarity and energy as I can.
Well, so your next book's coming out when?
Well, I'm hoping that it comes out in time for the World Fantasy Convention, conference, I forget what it's called. It's World Fantasy something. This year is going to be in Los Angeles, so I don't have to fly anyplace. And there's now, I think, 10 or 12 books in the series. So my mentor, John Reed, wrote one as well. That's called The Mountain of Ashes, and it was released a couple of months ago. And so we're hoping to have a sort of group presentation down there. Where we can, One thing I want to say about it, the cool thing about it, and I can't emphasize this too much, is writers, we all work on our own. It's a very isolated process. And even though I wasn't sitting in the same room with these other writers, and even though I had no idea what they were writing, there was a sense of fellowship, a sense of camaraderie at a distance, which was really wonderful. I recommend it. It made it a little bit less lonely.
Yeah.
To be working on the project. Yeah.
So, how do you feel about the future of literary expression? I mean, we're here at the Santa Barbara Writers Conference. A lot of people working on the whole gamut of writing. There's a lot of really fervent creation going on. It's a tough world out there, you know, in terms of publishing, but
yeah.
I think that there's a lot of potential. People are hungry for stories.
Always, always. And you're right, it is a lot more complicated out there. Somebody asked me what it was like in the publishing business these days, and I said, well, it's about 10 times easier than it used to be to get published, and it's about 100 times harder to make a living at it. And
right, for readers to find their way through all this stuff.
Yeah, all the self-publishing that goes on and everything, and sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. The thing that I mean, for myself, the way that I approach that is, you know, you're going to pry my pen out of my cold, moldering hand, so I would like to make a little bit more at it than I am.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that I don't like to see is, and I think it's in large part a result of more people competing for the monetary rewards. And I believe very much in the notion of a rising tide lifts all ships. I think camaraderie, because all of us are, it's very hard what we do, and we're the only ones who know how hard it is. Somebody who hasn't done it picks up a book, they read it, it seems like a magic trick. They don't see the hundreds and thousands of hours of writing stuff that you wind up throwing away. It's a very painful, long process that that you really have to dedicate yourself to. You have to love it to do it. And what I want to see is I just want to see writers be kind to each other. And by and large, I find that the vast majority of writers that I run to are. The skirmishes that go on, what I want to say is I think that all we have to do to have goodwill and camaraderie among the community of writers is simply to value it as an objective, to bear that always in mind, that we are brothers and sisters of the pen, and we all spend time standing in front of a mirror wondering if we're one of God's mistakes. and we all are going through the same trials, and congratulate each other when we do well, sympathize with each other when we don't, and if we don't agree about stuff, well, so be it. We're still writers.
All right. Well, thanks for chatting with us.
You bet.
Tune in to part two, which will be coming soon. Thank you to our listeners for joining us. This is Jack Eit from Wilder Utopia, coming to you from multiple undisclosed locations, under a bank of coast live oaks, next to a flowing stream that originates from deep underground. Find us at wilderutopia.com, and we encourage everyone to get your mind out into the wild.